Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Neurology Exam Prep from Yale Neurology Department. My name is Safa Abdelhakim. I have with me our program director, Dr. Jeremy Moeller. Today, we'll go through something that to me is very complicated, but hopefully we'll approach it in a simple way, neurocutaneous syndromes. How are you doing, Dr. Moeller?
I'm doing great. It's really nice to have a little extra music. I'm feeling very professional now. I think you made an excellent choice.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with a couple of disclaimers for this session. Again, all of this is purely for educational purposes. We're not providing clinical advice. I am not an expert in neurocutaneous syndromes, although I am a neurologist and engage in general neurology. I'm also an epilepsy specialist, so do treat patients with seizures, which is a common clinical correlate or clinical accompaniment of neurocutaneous syndromes. And sometimes I think it's actually better to have somebody who's not the deepest expert in these rare syndromes to discuss them, because the goal is to have a general overview and a general sense of the types of things you need to recognize clinically and certainly on various certification and in-service examinations. And I think sometimes we get lost in the trees when what we need to do is look at the forest and have a general overview. So I hope we can do that. I hope we can provide some structure on which our listeners who are residents can base their additional studying. A lot of the information I'll share is actually from notes that I made when I was studying for what's called the Canadian Royal College exam in neurology. And I've updated that with some updated information. And of course, that comes from multiple sources.
Wonderful. Why don't we get started and just give us a little bit of an approach to this topic, Dr. Moeller.
Sure. So the neurocutaneous syndromes are sometimes also referred to, you see this term less now, but also sometimes referred to as the phacomatoses. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And phacos, I guess, is the Greek term for birthmark or mother spot. And so that was a term that was used to describe disorders that had manifestations involving both the skin and the nervous system. What's common between all of these syndromes is the fact that we have characteristic skin manifestations for each of these syndromes and that there are neurological manifestations as well. So I think now we tend to use the term neurocutaneous syndromes, but some of our listeners may encounter the term phacomatoses, and I think those are basically equivalent terms. When we break down the neurocutaneous syndromes, I think there are some chunks that we can make. There's a dizzying array of eponymous terms, all of these hyphenated terms, which can become very difficult to keep track of. So I think what we'll try to do is break them down in some ways. And one way to break them down that I encountered when I was studying this topic in the past was to talk about those that had abnormalities of vascular tissue or vascular development, and those are what are called the angiodysplasias, and then those that did not have abnormalities that were abnormalities in other tissues, and those are the sort of non-angiomatous disorders. And of the angiodysplasias, you have ones that are fairly diffuse. And the two I think to be aware of there would be Osler-Rendu-Weber syndrome and ataxia telangiectasia. Mm-hmm. Of those that are a little more regional, probably the most famous of those would be Sturge-Weber syndrome, which often has regional angiodysplasia and has a very specific, often unilateral abnormality. And a few less common ones there are something called Wyburn-Mason syndrome and something called von Hippel-Lindau syndrome. And then the non-angiomatous, the ones that don't involve angioma tissue, include the neurofibromatoses. And the most common of those, and actually the most common neurocutaneous syndrome, would be neurofibromatosis type 1. But then there's also NF2, neurofibromatosis type 2. There's tuberous sclerosis, and then there's a handful of much rarer disorders that are infrequently encountered in clinical practice, but we do see, and those can include incontinentia pigmenti, hypomelanosis of Ito, and a few others. So to review, sort of the big chunks would be those angiodysplasias, which are either diffuse or regional, and then the non-angiomatous neurocutaneous syndromes.
Great. And the fact that, you know, Sturge-Weber produced redness on the face, we can tell that there's probably an angiomatous neurocutaneous syndrome.
Yeah, I think the picture of somebody with a large facial angioma of Sturge-Weber syndrome is famous and something that should be instantly identifiable to any neurology trainee. And I think that's right. That helps you break down that has to be an angiomatous problem and that it's regional because it often involves one portion of the face.
Why don't we start by talking about Osler-Rendo-Weber syndrome?
Absolutely. So and in general, for all of these, I'm going to talk a little bit about the genetics of these disorders, at least what is known about the genetics of these disorders, the skin manifestations of these disorders, and then the other clinical manifestations of these disorders, and sort of the important top line things to know about these disorders. And I think if we sort of break it down by the genetics, the skin manifestations, and then the neurological and other clinical manifestations and sort of chunk it in that way, we'll be in good shape. So Osler-Weber-Rendu syndrome, sometimes also known as hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia syndrome. This is autosomal dominant, and you see telangiectasias of the skin. So that's really important. You'll see skin telangiectasias. And often telangiectasias of the mucous membranes. And this should prompt when you see a exam question with a stem that includes nosebleeds, so epistaxis. One thing you might want to be thinking about is Osler-Weber-Rendu syndrome. The telangiectasias are often very small. They often blanch. Some common places that they might be seen are in the hands, especially on the fingertips, sometimes on the lips or other parts of the mucous membrane. And then, of course, there are neurological vascular malformations. And we can see cerebral vascular malformations that can lead to hemorrhage, and this can affect any part of the central nervous system. So these can be seen in the brain, they can be seen in the spinal cord, and we can also see these telangiectasias and other vascular malformations in the meninges. And there is a highly variable clinical presentation. So again, if we're breaking it down, the genetics are that this is autosomal dominant typically, that it is characterized by vascular abnormalities of the skin, especially of the mucous membranes, so the nosebleeds are really important, that there can be telangiectasias in multiple other tissues that it can include the central nervous system. And this is probably an affirmation for why a skin examination is really important in somebody with hemorrhage at a young age, for example. So That's hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia or Osler-Weber-Rendu syndrome. Just one Greek lesson, just to add as a little twist, is that telangiectasia comes from telos, which means end. You remember telomeres are the ends of the DNA. Angio, which of course is blood vessel, and ectasia means extension. So basically what you have are abnormalities at the end of the vascular tree. And that's why these are often small. They affect the small blood vessels, arterioles and venules, and then also the capillaries.
Great. And is there a particular diagnostic criteria?
Yeah. So I think there are variable diagnostic criteria, but they're often broken down by the fact that this is a genetic disorder. Nosebleeds. So again, this is like, I want to generate a Pavlovian response so that when you hear nosebleeds and hemorrhage, you're thinking hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia or Osler-Weber-Rendu syndrome. So family history, nosebleeds, skin telangiectasias, and then often AVMs in multiple distributions. And those can include the central nervous system. This is one that internal medicine people have to know about because it's common to have pulmonary AVMs or hepatic AVMs with this disorder as well, which may be even more common than the brain AVMs. All right, so I'm just going to cover ataxia telangiectasia relatively briefly. Again, to review the genetics of ataxia telangiectasia, this is a disorder that's autosomal recessive. So we mentioned that Osler-Weber-Rendu syndrome is autosomal dominant. Ataxia telangiectasia is typically autosomal recessive. The important thing to remember about ataxia telangiectasia is the ataxia part, and that is that this often presents in early childhood with cerebellar dysfunction, so with abnormalities of gait and other types of cerebellar problems. And then the clue is that these children also have telangiectasias, that they also have vascular abnormalities. And common places to see the vascular abnormalities include the conjunctiva. They can also be seen in the pinna of the ear, so on the earlobes is another place that this can be seen. And in comparison to Osler-Weber-Rendu, where the main cause of the neurological dysfunction is vascular malformations of the central nervous system, you often don't have structural abnormalities or any tumors in the brain with kids with ataxia telangiectasia. The primary problem is a primary cerebellar degeneration. That being said, kids with this disorder are at higher risk of developing tumors, including multiple types of malignant tumors.
We kind of addressed that also in Osler-Weber. Do these telangiectasias, if they happen in the brain or the meninges, cause seizure? Could they cause cortical irritation?
Yeah, so ataxia telangiectasia would be less likely because, as I said, we tend not to have central nervous system telangiectasias, and they're more skin manifestations. But in hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, if you have a brain arteriovenous malformation, an AVM, that very commonly, especially if it bleeds, can be associated with seizures. And certainly, we see seizures associated with any type of vascular malformation of the brain. So that's an excellent point. Osler-Weber-Rendu, in those patients that do have brain lesions, you could definitely see seizures.
Then we can move next to the regional angiomatous conditions like Sturge-Weber, which we already referred to several times.
Yeah, and I think we can't refer to Sturge-Weber syndrome too often because I think this is one, as I said before, that really should be instantly recognizable. So Sturge-Weber syndrome is not thought to be autosomal dominant or autosomal recessive. In most cases, this is related to a sporadic mutation. And the particular gene product, the particular protein that's involved is something that's encoded on chromosome 9, and it's called guanine nucleotide binding protein. And the result of this mutation is that individuals affected by this syndrome develop an angiomatosis of the leptomeninges, so an angiomatosis of the surrounding of the brain, usually on one side, with a cutaneous vascular malformation on the same time. And that's, of course, what we call the port wine stain, sometimes called the port wine nevus. And this is usually in the ophthalmic distribution of the trigeminal nerve. So it's often a port wine stain that is in the upper part of the face. Because these kids have leptomeningeal angiomatosis on that side, there is often but not always associated symptoms related to that. And they can include seizures, as you said before, Safa, with some of these other disorders. Again, if you have a vascular abnormality on that part of the brain, you could have focal seizures. You can have hemiparesis or other abnormalities because they're sometimes posterior, sometimes that's hemianopia. And then you can actually have strokes, and that's thought to be related to a Steele syndrome. On neuroimaging, this is something that often comes up on exams is a characteristic neuroimaging findings on that side. And there is characteristically a calcification of the leptomeningeal tissues on that side, often in the posterior aspects of the head. Those calcifications are sometimes called, referred to as the tram track sign. And that is basically because there's sort of this parallel calcification of cortical tissues, where there are these sort of parallel regions, these linear parallel regions of calcification that kind of look like the tracks you might see in the pavement on a tram. And often on imaging, you can also see contrast enhancement on both MRI and CT because of the angiomatosis on that side. And because of the progressive nature of this problem, sometimes you can see hemispheric atrophy in addition to the calcification. So to summarize, Sturge-Weber is really our most common of the regional angiomatous neurocutaneous syndromes. And the big thing is that you get this leptomeningeal angiomatosis on one side. On the same side, you have the port wine nevus, usually in the upper part of the face. And the imaging abnormalities are usually on that side, usually maximal in the posterior part of the brain. And calcifications in one hemisphere, that's going to trigger you to think of Sturge-Weber syndrome. The port wine stain should trigger you to think about Sturge-Weber. And again, think about things that could be clinical manifestations of this unilateral angiomatosis, which could include hemiparesis, focal onset seizures, and other unilateral hemispheric manifestations.
Moving down the list of the angiomatous regional neurocutaneous syndromes, we can talk about my Myburn-Mason syndrome. I might probably just mispronounced it, but go ahead.
Yeah, Wyburn-Mason syndrome is probably one that doesn't require a ton of discussion, but just to be aware of. This is often associated with retinal AVMs, so that's one characteristic feature of this. There is often angiomas of the optic nerve as well. There can be brain angiomas, and it can be associated with vascular nevi in the trigeminal region. So it's often associated with cerebral AVMs that involve the visual pathways, that involve the retinal regions, and can have facial angiomas on that side as well. So I'm not going to say much beyond that. The reason that it tends to involve those visual pathways and can also involve midbrain and cerebellar involvement has to do with the development of the vascular tissues in those regions. But it's not one that comes up a lot, just something to be aware of, that Wyburn-Mason syndrome is a much less frequently encountered version of a focal or regional angiomatous neurocutaneous syndrome.
Thank you for that. And then we can move on to discuss von Hippel-Lindau syndrome.
So von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, also called VHL, is also autosomal dominant. So that's the genetics of it. There is incomplete penetrance of the genetic abnormality. And for that reason, there can be a significant amount of variability in the clinical presentation. For those of our listeners that love to remember chromosomes, the protein is encoded on chromosome 3. Again, I think that's one of those things, just giving some side advice about preparation for examinations. Unless you're encountering that all the time or you're a particular expert in these areas, most of us are going to write down a table of some of these characteristics, including the chromosomes, and just look at that periodically to try to remember it, often the day before or the week before an exam. That's sort of straight memorization. I don't find it helpful in terms of the clinical characteristics. But what is important genetically is that it's autosomal dominant with variable penetrance. So different family members may have far different severity of the disease. And the big thing to know about von Hippel-Lindau syndrome is that most patients develop a tumor called a hemangioblastoma. And the most common region to see hemangioblastoma is in the cerebellar hemisphere, although it can also be seen in the spinal cord or the brainstem. And in many of these patients, there is also a retinal hemangioblastoma. So you can see some association or some commonality with Wyburn-Mason syndrome, although slightly different in terms of the type of vascular malformation that you're going to see. And because of the retinal hemangioblastomas, these patients can develop visual difficulties. Of course, they can develop neurological manifestations related to their brain hemangioblastomas. As I said, the severity of the disease is going to be highly variable. So another one of the regional angiomatous phacomatoses or neurocutaneous syndrome. So again, to summarize, probably the biggest one you need to know about is Sturge-Weber, unilateral, leptomeningeal angiomatosis, the port wine stain, got it. Wyburn-Mason, just be aware that it exists. And again, it's one of the other regional angiomatosis, often with eye and brain abnormalities. And then Waden-Hippel-Lindau syndrome, often these hemangioblastomas, which is the characteristic finding, usually in the posterior fossa, brain stem, cerebellar hemisphere, sometimes spinal cord, with retinal hemangioblastoma as the quote-unquote cutaneous manifestation of this.
Yeah, that's definitely an important one to remember for the exam. That wraps up the angiomatous syndromes. Why don't we talk about the non-angiomatous and start with neurofibromatosis type 1, which is the most common one.
Yeah, so neurofibromatosis, we have type 1 and type 2. They can be hard to keep straight. You know, our listeners will encounter patients with neurofibromatosis type 1. It's common enough that I think that most residents, most neurologists will encounter patients with this problem. And neurofibromatosis type 1 is also sometimes called von Recklinghausen's disease. And I remember when I was a resident, a neurosurgery resident taught me that the way to remember that the mutation is on chromosome 17 is that von Recklinghausen has 17 letters. So it's one of those things. First of all, you would have to be able to spell von Recklinghausen correctly, although it's spelled pretty much how it's said. And then from there, I guess you could sort out that it's a chromosome 17 abnormality. In terms of the genetics, autosomal dominant, but again, much like von Hippel-Lindau, it has variable penetrance. So there is often a high degree of variability in the expression of this disorder. And like a lot of the non-angiomatous neurocutaneous syndromes, the gene that's involved encodes a protein that's important in tumor suppression. And so if you remember that, you know that you're going to see tumors. You're going to see the emergence of tumors in multiple regions, and we'll go through the main types of tumors. So the gene on chromosome 17 for neurofibromatosis encodes a specific protein called neurofibromin. And basically, you lose function in neurofibromin, and because you lose function, you have a loss of tumor suppression, and you get proliferation of tissues resulting in the multiple lesions that can be involved. So in terms of the clinical manifestations of this disorder, much as its name implies, you're going to see neurofibromas. And neurofibromas are basically tumors arising from the peripheral nerve sheath. They will often emerge over time. There will often be evolution of these lesions over time. And there can be a number of different types of neurofibromas. You can have, and we can all remember images of patients with a lot of cutaneous neurofibromas. So you see these skin lesions, which are very superficial, and those are the cutaneous neurofibromas. There can be subcutaneous neurofibromas, and they are often associated with a lot of pain. So this can be an extremely painful disorder in some cases. And then there are these really not as well circumscribed plexiform neurofibromas that are sort of more diffuse and less well circumscribed. And those are the ones that can be a problem because they can progress to what is called a malignant nerve sheath tumor. And the malignant nerve sheath tumor is the thing that's going to be a big problem, as its name implies. Because this is a disorder of tumor suppression, you are also going to see other types of tumors. And a few that come up on examinations a lot include the optic nerve glioma. So again, Pavlovian response, you hear NF1, you're thinking about neurofibromas, which can be cutaneous, subcutaneous, plexiform, and then you really should be thinking about optic nerve gliomas, and those happen in kids. So those are going to emerge in early childhood if they emerge at all. And they won't be in every child, but if you see them, they'll be early on. You can get primary brain tumors, so you can get astrocytomas with these. You can see meningiomas. Those are going to be less commonly seen than in NF2, and we'll talk about that a little bit. In adults, you can see pheochromocytoma. Yeah, so we've talked a little bit about the tumors associated with neurofibromatosis type 1, and of course, there are some classic skin lesions, and these are things that, again, should generate a Pavlovian response in us when we're studying these disorders. We have café au lait macules. So these are large, dark macules that can be located in a number of different parts of the body. Typically, they are located on the trunk. A second lesion that's often seen, and again, something that's good to look for, you're going to have to get a patient into a gown to really look for it, is axillary freckling. Of course, we do see iris hamartomas, and those are what are called Lisch nodules. They really can only be seen well with a slit lamp examination. So those are probably your big three in terms of the skin manifestations.
So the three key things that we need to be looking for is café au lait spots, axillary freckling, and iris hamartomas, which could be detected best with a slit lamp exam.
Also called Lisch nodules.
Lisch nodules, exactly. And this is a key reflex that we should think about neurofibromatosis type 1. In addition, we have optic gliomas, sometimes meningiomas, astrocytomas. Those are common tumors that we should be thinking about when we hear neurofibromatosis type 1, although meningiomas are more in neurofibromatosis type 2, which we'll discuss next.
Yeah. So, there are diagnostic criteria that exist for neurofibromatosis. And again, those I'm going to let our listeners look up on their own, but they consist of the things that we've summarized. So just briefly to summarize, again, genetics, skin manifestations, other and neurological manifestations. In terms of the genetics, this is an autosomal dominant with variable penetrance. So part of the diagnostic criteria can be having a family member with this disorder. There is skin manifestations, as you've just summarized, and we can't summarize this too often. And that includes the café au lait macules, often on the trunk, the axillary freckling, and then the iris hamartomas, also known as Lisch nodules. And again, just to remember, best seen with slit lamp examination. So often hard to see at the bedside. We can do a fancy thing. I don't know if we've ever done this with you, Safa, but in our resident clinic, the direct ophthalmoscope, the little handheld ophthalmoscope, I know a lot of us use the really fancy ophthalmoscopes now that have the sort of better view, but on the little simple direct ophthalmoscope, there is the little slit setting. And you can use that as a simplified version of a slit lamp to look specifically at the iris. And in doing so, you can see those hamartomas. And we've done that on a few occasions with patients in our clinic. Then, of course, the neurological manifestations are the peripheral nerve tumors. Mainly, that's going to be your neurofibromas of different types, but also the optic nerve glioma, and then rarely other types of brain and cranial tumors. And then a couple of other things that come up. Many patients with this disorder may have learning disabilities. Some have seizures likely related to some of the brain abnormalities. And then many have bone abnormalities. And those can include scoliosis, which can develop over time. Some things that come up and can be seen on examination are that some people with neurofibromatosis can have pseudoarthrosis or bone dysplasia. So those are important to remember. So that's NF1, autosomal dominant, tumor suppressor, peripheral nerve and other tumors, and then the skin lesions we mentioned.
Great summary. And how about neurofibromatosis type 2?
So neurofibromatosis type 2 is also autosomal dominant. And again, the same neurosurgery resident told me that I can remember this that it's encoded on chromosome 22. We don't have to count the number of words or letters in the words or anything like that. This is much simpler. So it's chromosome 22 is the disorder. For those who are fans of King Arthur, the gene that's encoded is Merlin, which is another type of tumor suppressor gene. And then the other thing about 2-2, of course, is that the characteristic neurological manifestation of neurofibromatosis type 2 is bilateral acoustic neuroma. So that's 2-2, you know, two things, bilateral. So that's how I remember the genetics of NF2. I don't know if that's going to work for our listeners, but I've never forgotten it. And that is chromosome 22 and King Arthur's friend Merlin, which is a gene that is another tumor suppressor gene.
Merlin 22 and bilateral acoustic neuromas.
There's your Pavlovian response to that one. This should be a monosynaptic reflex.
Absolutely.
So just to summarize the neurological manifestations, the most common thing is bilateral acoustic neuromas. Those can be very difficult to treat, can result in progressive hearing loss, often need surgical treatment, and can be a real problem in many patients. And then the other type of tumor that's very common in this disorder, and we alluded to this already, is meningiomas. And patients with NF2 often have multiple meningiomas. They can get other types of tumors. Those can include gliomas. They can include ependymomas. And then many of the patients have eye abnormalities. So they can have cataracts in many cases, and they can have retinal hamartomas. But I think the big ones and the ones to remember would be multiple meningiomas, bilateral acoustic neuroma, and those are probably the most common manifestations.
And the skin findings are more notable in NF1. That's also another distinction I like to make in my head.
Yeah, I think that's an important one to remember, is that those common skin manifestations that we see in NF1 will be less commonly seen in NF2. There is some commentary about what are called NF2 plaques. These are a type of skin lesion that can be seen in a portion of patients with neurofibromatosis type 2, but much less common than what is seen in NF1.
Wonderful. Another very important condition for neurologists to know is tuberous sclerosis.
Yeah, and tuberous sclerosis is something that is a little bit closer to my heart, because I do have several patients with this disorder, because epilepsy, especially refractory epilepsy, is a common manifestation of tuberous sclerosis.
Absolutely.
So much like NF1 and NF2, tuberous sclerosis is autosomal dominant. I don't have a fun or exciting way to help you remember which chromosome. You just have to remember it's chromosome 9 for TSC1 for tuberous sclerosis complex type 1. And you have to remember that it's chromosome 16 for tuberous sclerosis complex type 2. And again, with both of these genes, there is a mutation that affects a protein that is important in what's called the mTOR pathway. And basically, the mTOR pathway is important for the regulation of the cell cycle. And it's mTOR stands for mammalian target of rapamycin. The two genes involved in this mTOR pathway, for TSC1, one of the genes that's mutated in tuberous sclerosis, it's Hamerton. And that's easy to remember because hamartoma. And then the second one for TSC2, the subtype, both TSC1 and TSC2 can produce similar clinical features, but the genes to remember are Hamerton and tuberin. And both Hamerton and tuberin basically modulate the mTOR pathway, and loss of this function leads to the lesions that you see in tuberous sclerosis. And the reason why that's important is that one of the treatments is something that inhibits the mTOR pathway called everolimus. Everolimus particularly has been approved for the treatment of one of the more common types of tumors that we see in this, the subependymal giant cell astrocytoma.
Another reflex, monosynaptic one, is SEGA and tuberous sclerosis.
Absolutely. And this is often adjacent to the foramen of Monroe. And that's really important, because one of the problems that can cause, of course, is an obstruction and then hydrocephalus and other types of problems related to that. Cortical tubers are another really important manifestation, neurological manifestation of tuberous sclerosis. These tubers are often associated with epilepsy. So this is an important element in the generation of epilepsy. And then we can see subependymal nodules. So these are nodules that are growing along the edges in the subependymal tissue, along the edges of the ventricles, and very commonly, usually, in the lateral ventricles. And these subependymal nodules and the tubers can calcify. So often when you're seeing multiple calcified lesions, including those adjacent to the ventricles, the lateral ventricles, that might be a clue that the diagnosis is tuberous sclerosis. In addition to the central nervous system lesions, which we've talked about, and the big three being the tubers, the subependymal nodules, and our famous SEGA adjacent to the foramen Moreau, there are also a number of other types of tumors, and it's very common to see different types of tumors that have to be monitored carefully in patients with tuberous sclerosis. There can be a renal angiomyolipoma, renal cell carcinoma. There can be cardiac rhabdomyomas. There can be retinal hematomas, as we see in some of these other disorders. And there can be lung lesions, and those are the lymphatic leiomyomatosis in the lungs. So those are all really important to be aware of. And then finally, we have to get to the cutaneous part. So we've talked about the neuro, we've talked about tumor suppression, and then we have to talk about the classic cutaneous findings. And again, these ones should also be monosynaptic. These ones should be ones that we know about really well and can see, because we'll see them in patients. We'll see hypopigmented macules. These are sometimes called ash leaf spots. And basically, they're these little small areas of hypopigmentation in parts of the skin that are easily identifiable. And sometimes we see images of those on examination. It's very common to get facial angiofibromas, and they're often over the bridge of the nose, over the cheeks. Those types of areas are sort of classic. Take a careful look at the hands. You can often see these ungual or periungual fibromas in some patients. And the thing about tuberous sclerosis is that it's sometimes not identified early on. I think more and more as we're recognizing it, it will be. But there are times when we can see patients with tuberous sclerosis who present to our epilepsy clinic who have not been diagnosed before. And the last thing that sometimes we see and can fit with the sort of clinical characteristics of tuberous sclerosis is what's called a Sjögren patch, which is S-H-A green, Sjögren patch. This is a nevus of the connective tissue, less common than the other ones we mentioned, but it's often this skin-colored or oval shape, sometimes a pigmented lesion that has a little bit of a rough character in some cases. And apparently, according to what we've read, is that Sjögren is a type of leather, sort of a rougher type of leather, and that's one of the reasons that these are called Sjögren patches.
Great.
So to summarize, hypopigmented macules are probably the most common. Facial angiofibromas, and again, classically sort of across the bridge of the nose, over the nose itself, and in the cheeks, the maxillary distribution of the trigeminal nerve in that region. Periungual or ungual fibromas, often just above the fingernails. And then I don't know. I haven't seen too many Sjögren patches, but something that might come up in your studying.
Anything else to add, Dr. Moeller, about tuberous sclerosis?
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add. Again, tuberous sclerosis is sort of a classic neurocutaneous syndrome. You'll encounter it in clinical practice, and you'll encounter questions about it in your studying. So Safa, actually, why don't we go through each of these and summarize what we just talked about? And let's hear what your Pavlovian knee-jerk responses to each of these are. So we'll talk about the types of things that should come to the front of your mind when we talk about these neurocutaneous syndromes, because we've really talked about a lot. We're not experts in this area, but we're really teaching survival skills. And that's both good for clinical practice and good for, getting through the day in terms of exams. So we talked about how we have the angiodysplasias and the non-angiomatous neurocutaneous syndromes.
Okay.
So the diffuse disorders, Osler-Rendu-Weber syndrome or hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking some telangiectasias that can involve the meninges, could lead to some seizures, could be elsewhere. But as a neurologist, this is what's sticking in my mind. It could also involve the spinal cord as well.
Yeah, and the other thing I would throw in there is nosebleeds. So Osler, Weber, Rendu, these are the people with skin telangiectasias, nosebleeds, and then they can have brain, lung, and other types of vascular malformations. All right, what about ataxia telangiectasia?
There's a cerebellar problem. The cerebellar is malfunctioning, and hence the ataxia. They are predisposed to different kinds of tumors, and they will have telangiectasias.
Yeah, so ataxia telangiectasia, early onset cerebellar dysfunction, that's the ataxia part, and then cutaneous telangiectasias. Yeah, the other thing I'd mention about ataxia telangiectasia is that you often see those telangiectasia on the cornea, and you can see it on the ear, the pinna of the ear. Those would be the big ones. All right, so those are the diffuse ones, Osler, Weber, Rendu, and ataxia telangiectasia. What about the regional ones? So Sturge, Weber, go.
So what I remember about Sturge Weber always is the port wine stain with, on the same side, leptomeningeal angiomatosis that can manifest in imaging with calcifications or the tram track appearance. And those could cause focal deficits contralateral to that side, as well as some focal onset seizures.
Excellent. That's Sturge Weber for you. Let's leave Wyburn-Mason syndrome and von Hippel-Lindau for now.
Von Hippel-Lindau, I do want to have one reflex that I would like to remember is the hemangioblastomas. But
hemangioblastomas, posterior fossa, often cerebellar, can be in the spinal cord, can be multiple. Good points. All right, now we go to the non-angiomatous neurocutaneous syndromes. So we have the big ones. We have three, NF1, NF2, and TS. All right, NF1, go.
All right. That would be the café au lait spots, the axillary freckling, the Lish nodules. And as far as the brain tumors that we need to remember are optic glioma. You could have astrocytoma, less likely meningioma.
And the neurofibromas are going to be cutaneous, subcutaneous, or plexiform. The plexiform ones are the ones that progress to the malignant nerve sheath tumor. And NF1, remember what chromosome?
Yes. NF1, regardless of whatever acronym the fancy one was, is chromosome 17.
And you got it.
NF2 is, I did actually appreciate the acronym a lot, but I just can't reproduce the word again.
Von Recklinghausen.
There we go. And NF2 is chromosome 22. Yep. And some things to remember about NF2 is the bilateral acoustic neuromas and multiple meningiomas.
And do you remember the gene for NF1 and NF2?
Yes. The gene for NF1 is neurofibromin, and neurofibromatosis type 2, it's the Merlin gene.
You got it. King Arthur's friend.
Yes, that I remember.
What are the two genes involved in tuberous sclerosis complex?
The first subtype is Hamerton, and the second subtype is tuberin.
And all these genes, what do they do in general?
So all the non-angiomatous neurocutaneous ones, those are tumor suppressors, and that's why we need to be paying attention to what kind of tumors people get.
And and let's go through tuberous sclerosis. This is our last thing. So what are the brain tumors that you get with tuberous sclerosis, and what are the other types of tumors that people get with tuberous sclerosis?
Absolutely. So the one that I always like to remember for tuberous sclerosis is the subependymal giant cell astrocytoma, or SEGA. In addition to SEGA, you get subependymal nodules and tubers, cortical tubers, and those are actually the ones that could cause refractory epilepsy in patients with tuberous sclerosis. And then as far as the other tumors, there are renal angiomyolipomas. There are cardiac rhabdomyomas, that one always remember from medical school. And there are retinal nodules.
And then what are the skin lesions that we see in TS?
Sure. So this is going to be your Ashley. There's going to be facial angiofibromas, less common, but chagrin patch, which is sort of this like connective tissue skin finding common at the lower back. You guys could kind of Google it and just get a little mental connection here.
That's and then the fingernails, the ungual fibromas. Yeah, and the facial angiofibromas, again, really commonly over the bridge of the nose. That would be the place to look for it.
All right, wonderful. You can check people's hands and people's skin when you get young people with brain bleeds, tumors, and seizures. This is a key point from today's lecture.
One common thing, it comes up, I think we've talked about it in other sessions, but some kids with tuberous sclerosis can develop West syndrome or infantile spasms, epileptic spasms, and the treatment for that typically is vigabatrin. That's been shown to be very effective. So just something to be remembered in kids with epileptic spasms and tuberous sclerosis.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Moeller. Thank you guys for sharing your time with us. And hopefully this has been a good educational time for all of us. It definitely was for me.
I'm so tired. This is really hard, but hopefully this is a worthwhile one. We're all just non-experts doing our best.
Yes. Thank you so much. Take care.